Hello and welcome back to Warrior Radio. I'm Tony Balbin, and in today's episode, I sit down with Martin Witke, who is a world-class expert in neurofeedback. And I first learned about Martin through a previous guest, Adam Curry, who attended one of Marty's two-week neurofeedback intensives and said it was one of the most transformative experiences of his life. And here's a clip from the interview.
It's like the most profound meditation that you've ever had, but times 10, or at least for me it was. The frontal lobe awakens and you start to feel not like your head is in the clouds. It's not a kind of transcendence or like a state of being that is ephemeral. It's the opposite. It's much, much more grounded and here and now than you were before, which was kind of surprising, but it makes sense. So like, to me, I kind of relate enlightenment to be not as a transcendence, but as a deepening of your presence, of being really, really here. And once you kind of feel through feedback what it's like to have your frontal lobe awake, you can more easily reproduce it.
So in today's episode, I pick Marty's brain on how we help spearhead the neurofeedback industry in the 80s and 90s, why there is not a one-size-fits-all model for neurofeedback. We talk about how to find the right neurofeedback professional to work with. We have a really interesting discussion about gamma brainwaves and how they bind various areas of the brain together. We talk about how to use neurofeedback to get into flow states. And I really pick Martin's brain on his two-week neurofeedback intensive that Adam previously went on and was very, very speaking highly of. So if you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast Warrior Radio. Subscribe, tell a friend, and give us a rating, as ratings really help push our podcast up the iTunes rankings and help get a lot of these little understood, little talked about topics out into the masses. So with all that said, let's dive into today's episode with Martin Witke. Enjoy. For those that don't know, can you tell us who you are and what you do?
Well, Marty Witke, I began doing what I'm doing about 35 years ago. Basically, I was working in a psychiatric hospital. It was an inpatient treatment center, not for severe psychiatric disorders, but more for a chemical dependency, alcoholism, depression, anxiety, and so on. And a small facility up in the North Georgia mountains, a beautiful place, almost like a resort. I happened to be living up there studying at an ashram, studying Kriya Yoga, yoga philosophy in the tradition of Paramhansa Yogananda. So I was a hardcore yogi meditator. So one day I wandered into town and went to this treatment facility and went for a tour of it. And within a few weeks, I was offered a position there designing and implementing a program for them that would run alongside their treatment program. And the reason for that is the medical director saw very quickly that there was a lot of potential in what I knew and what I did. So anyway, I started out there just teaching meditation, quickly realized I had to bring credibility to the meditation model. And this was back in the early 80s, so it wasn't widely accepted yet like it is now. So I realized biofeedback was scientific. It was widely accepted by the scientific and medical community. And to make a long story short, I realized that brainwave biofeedback was the key, even though the equipment back then was very expensive and a little kind of, from the perspective right now, sort of dinosaur equipment. But we still got very good results when we added it to the treatment program. And then, I spent 12 or 13 years there treating thousands and thousands and thousands of patients in the hospital inpatient. and developed a lot of what is out there now, and was one of the first people, or the first person, to do it inpatient. And that then, of course, left the hospital, opened up clinics in Atlanta, Georgia, and then in Hilversum, Netherlands, and trained a lot of practitioners in Europe, and continue to unfold. I'm out here in Santa Barbara, California now, moved here about 6 years ago because of some very good connections and openings here, and now just getting ready to continue the work. I do work on many levels. I have expertise in neurodevelopmental disorders, so we work with autism and those sorts of problems. But we're moving more and more towards the peak performance model. We have a lot of athletes, elite athletes, on board now. Plus, we just finished 3 years of working through government, local, and state bureaucratic red tape, and are getting ready to launch, actually this weekend, tomorrow, we're launching our study on parolees to test if we can reduce recidivism rates. So we're doing a three-year study, 180 subjects with a control group, randomized. We have really top-notch cognitive and research psychologists working with us. And each parolee will get 40 sessions of neurofeedback, measured and tracked over time, and then see if we can reduce recidivism rates, as has been reported before. So California is watching this very carefully. California would like to actually offer rehabilitation to people who have been in prison more than incarceration and punishment, which is revolutionary here in the United States, a very nice thing. So my work covers a broad range. I do typical neurofeedback work with clinical disorders, but I also have this meditation model, which is really where I started and where a lot of my expertise really comes from. So there you are. That's sums up 35 years.
Well, in back in the 80s with neurofeedback, like you were saying, it was such a new field, especially with meditation. I'd imagine no one was doing that type of thing. So as far as, you know, in your early days, where did you train? Like, did you have to sort of create these techniques on your own, or was there someone that you trained under?
I worked with Adam Crane for a little while. He had a company, he's retired now, but he had a company called American Biotech. And he was a very, very nice guy. He was a Krishnamurti devotee. And so his perspective and emphasis was sort of this meditative model. I also immediately went to Menninger's Institute, because Menninger's, you know, was really the source of a lot of the meditation model, even though it was more psychodynamic. They're the ones who really started alpha theta training. So I went and studied there, and immediately, because, see, the luxury that I had was that I was working in a psychiatric hospital with a full staff, medical director, counselors, psychiatrist, psychologist, and nursing staff. And every day we would meet for our staff meeting, and I would get instant feedback on how the patients were responding to what I was doing. So I had a laboratory that enabled me to see what was working and what wasn't. And I'm a very good observer, so I instantly started to modify protocols to guide people in the appropriate direction. The problem back then was the technology was, you know, we were very happy to have 1 megabyte of RAM on our computers then. So that's changed things dramatically now. Plus, some of that early research that I was looking at back then with, for instance, the transcendental meditation people, there's other research that goes back into the 50s on brainwaves and meditation. It was very scattered, and you really couldn't find consensus or consistency. The different types of meditation showed different types of things in the brainwave patterns. However, I did immediately recognize some very interesting things in the EEG, which have been corroborated now by Richard Davidson, the fellow who studies the Dalai Lama's people. And it is higher brainwave frequencies, gamma. But it's not one particular frequency in the brain that makes the difference. It's a correlation or a relationship between the frequencies. And I know that you recently interviewed Judith Pennington of Awakened Mind Emphasis. And I think that that is the closest paradigm to what the meditation model really is. So, and then of course I was a hardcore meditator, and by that I mean I meditated several hours a day living at this yoga ashram. So I was also teaching that alongside of the neurofeedback, because neurofeedback is not meditation, because neurofeedback, you're training very specific states. Meditation is a dynamic flow that when you sit there for 10, 20, 30, 40 minutes, your brain goes through many changes, and a lot of it depends on, number one, what type of meditation you're using, and number two, how advanced you are in your meditation practice. So these are all important factors.
Mm. One thing I wanted to cover was this idea of neuroplasticity, how the brain was able to be molded and altered, which is typically associated with children, but adults still have the ability to be neuroplastic. So can you talk about neurofeedback and how it's linked to neuroplasticity?
Sure. I mean, neuroplasticity continues till we die. You're right. It is more pronounced the younger we are. Up till about 7 years old, it's pretty pronounced. But any kind of a trauma or strong input, strong impression that is sort of projected at us is going to alter pathways, and we call that neuroplasticity. The critical factor is dopamine, the neurotransmitter dopamine that we know is in charge of pleasure and reward. And that is really the necessary component for neuroplasticity to occur. Why? There's basic instinctual purposes for that. We are attracted to things where there is a reward. And so dopamine sort of is the neurotransmitter, the brain chemical, that if something catches your attention and you perceive a future reward, dopamine squirts and allows brains to the synapses to alter and modify accordingly. So, I mean, neuroplasticity is not some big mystery anymore. We're all constantly under the influence of our environment, of our friends, of our politics, of our religion, and all those things are shaping our brains and our networks. In many people, we can inadvertently become victims. I mean, there's a whole, I'm sure you've heard of this, there's a whole science called neuromarketing. Billions of dollars in that field, where the marketers are simply testing what creates an association in your brain with wanting to buy a certain product. Has nothing to do with the rational mind, has to do with creating neuroplasticity and driving those dopamine reward systems, sometimes out of fear, to buy their particular product. It's neuroplasticity. I mean, every time we turn on the TV, listen to the radio, watch an interview, decide we want to buy this pair of pants versus those pair of pants, get our hair cut this certain way instead of that way, it's all the result of neuroplasticity and our brains being shaped by outside influences. The key is to learn how to be conscious of this thing we call neuroplasticity, and realize that if we're not careful, we can be inundated with outside influences that are literally shaping who we are. So first, you have to become aware that this is a constant thing happening all day long. Secondly, you can realize that you can change that either through neurofeedback or through meditation. And meditation, appropriate and proper meditation, is self-directed neuroplasticity. Because if you sit there and you meditate on calm, peace, centeredness, quiet, compassion, unconditional love, whatever you choose, guess what? You're producing changes in the brain. I mean, you can even look at MRIs and see that those areas of the brain are getting bigger and more robust. At the same time, when our mind and our thoughts goes towards thoughts of depression, worry, anxiety, fear, obviously those parts of the brain also correspond with that, and the ruts get dug in deeper and deeper and deeper. So first thing is to be aware of the factors that influence our neuroplasticity unconsciously. Second is to take charge, and we can direct where our neuroplasticity goes. The challenge is, the earlier the traumas in our life, the deeper the grooves. And some people spend lifetimes trying to get over trauma that occurred very young, and it's a challenge. I work with a lot of those people. But there's still pathways can be undone. It just takes strong work.
I'd love for you to just sort of go through a protocol that you have with a typical person, say, with ADD, and they want to change these neural pathways in their brain that's causing this, issues that they're having. So how does a typical session look like, and what's the type of protocol that you use to handle this type of issue that people have?
Okay, it's a multifactorial problem. Any problem with the brain does not usually have one particular source. It's a bit more complicated than that. And what I know from my experience with individual brains is that there is no one size fits all model. And that's very important because you have to look at each individual, their history, what they've been through, and their EEG. And EEG stands for electroencephalography. So you have to look at what is their brain doing, and is what their brain doing, is it wrong? Is it contributing to their symptoms and or their diagnosis or their problems? And how do you correct that? And the correction is often multi-level. I mean, if somebody has a concussion or a number of concussions, that has to be dealt with. If somebody has had a trauma, which now, we know that 4 out of 5 women have been somehow harassed or some other way, shape, or form of sexual problems have been perpetrated on them. So the PTSD is a very strong factor that we see, not necessarily at a clinical level, but at a subclinical level, where people walk around with traumas that are definitely influencing how they think, how they feel, how they behave. So we have to look at that. And even with ADHD, you can find those types of traumas. Then you have to look at neurodevelopmental issues. And one of the biggest ones that is often overlooked is diet and nutrition. It's a mess with many of the people I see. So we have to straighten that out and make sure there's no nutritional deficiencies or problems there. So once we, look at an individual's brain map, from that, I can determine what the appropriate approach is going to be as far as neurofeedback goes, if there needs to be any work with trauma, and if there needs to be any dietary or supplement adjustments. It's a whole, you can't just say, okay, you have ADHD, let's just make your brain do this and you'll be better. It just doesn't work that way. I mean, I wish it was that simple. So oftentimes we find that we have to address this multifactorial components of what is probably contributing to the symptoms that we call ADHD. And that doesn't just apply to ADHD. This applies to depression, to anxiety, to peak performance issues, to relationship issues, and even meditation, and so on. These are all the factors that we have to look at.
And once you've diagnosed all the issues that sort of need to be addressed, from what I understand, one of the ways that you do use neurofeedback is it's linked with a video game. So can you talk about what these games are and how they work?
Yeah, the games don't really matter a lot. The games are just the feedback component. This is operant conditioning. So the games aren't what influences the brain. What influences the brain is giving it feedback when it begins to shift or alter its pattern. And that's actually quite a misunderstanding that I'm realizing now, that people think these games or the videos or whatever the feedback is important. It could just be a sound going bing, bing, bing. Doesn't need to be anything fancy. The brain simply has to be given some kind of visual, auditory, or tactile feedback when it is approaching the appropriate state. And what I mean by the appropriate state is when it is reducing activity that may be not damaging, but may not be good activity. So the brain just needs a discrete, simple signal. It can be a video game, it can be a sound, it can be a computer monitor turning green and then turning red when the brain's not doing the right thing. The feedback doesn't matter a lot. What matters is the appropriate brain waves are being measured and modified. It's simply a conditioning process, and the brain will know exactly what to do eventually once you give it the appropriate feedback.
And I'd imagine you would have to target specific areas of the brain depending on what you diagnosed with the patient. But there's a lot of neurofeedback devices, especially the consumer end ones, that are really sort of cookie cutter type of headsets. So what's your take on these headsets and how they stack up with the actual professional grade devices that you use?
Yeah, it's this is a challenge right now because neurofeedback has become a novelty. So you're correct. There are several headsets out on the market right now. Again, unfortunately, there's no one size fits all model. I think the results are going to be proportional to how much you individualize the protocols. I'm working with a company out of Australia right now called Focus Band, who've created a headband with a EEG amplifier in it that's Bluetooth. So we created apps on phones. But I insisted at the beginning that there was not going to be a one-size-fits-all model. And although I really appreciate the simplicity of some of these headsets, and this focus band is very simple. It's just a band with Velcro, and the electrodes go over the forehead. So I had to look very carefully. Is there a way to individualize protocols for the focus band? Because they were mostly working with completely with elite athletes in Australia. They were working with golfers, and they were having remarkable results. They got one golfer from, I think, 39 ranked to number one, and now they're working with me here in the United States. But so what I've created for this is four or five individualized protocols depending upon the person's EEG. And I should say, I don't like to use the word diagnosis, and I don't like to use the word treat, because we're really not doing that. We're just looking at the brain. We know what optimal performance as far as brain waves go, and we're just trying to shift the brain towards optimal performance. But again, optimal performance for one person might not be optimal performance for another person, and that's where the one-size-fits-all, as you say, cookie-cutter model fails. And I know people report to me who are using these headsets. You know, some people get great results, but I don't, nobody's really done a head-to-head research study yet comparing different modalities and different approaches. So we can't really say, but my experience is again, there's no one-size-fits-all model. The brain just doesn't work that way. You can look at 20 people's EEGs and you're going to see 20 very different EEGs, different things happening. So that it stands to reason, and it's just logical that you can't give everybody the same path to go down. You have to see where they're at, what's going on, and then direct them accordingly.
When I spoke to Adam Curry, he really emphasized that this isn't a toy. I mean, this is really serious stuff. And I'd imagine if you're being serious about wanting to use neurofeedback to improve your life, you should really find a professional that knows what they're doing. So can you talk about just this idea of finding someone who's experienced and who's had proper training to work with neurofeedback?
Yeah, I mean, there is an organization called BCIA. It stands for the Biofeedback Certification International Alliance. And that is a certifying body worldwide for biofeedback and neurofeedback practitioners. But I want to be honest with you here, because just like we've seen in other fields, like clinical hypnosis, even chiropractic. So what you see happening eventually is there's sort of things begin to dilute as more practitioners come in and sort of jump on the bandwagon, and training is not as efficacious as we would like it to be. And there are many different approaches to neurofeedback out there. So if I want to refer somebody to, you know, across the United States to somebody in New York, I have no idea, unless I know the person and I've trained the practitioner, exactly what they're doing. Very few people, in fact, maybe one or two others in the world, have the same approach that I have, for instance. I mean, I'm spiritually based with what I do. In other words, I am really working to wake people up. I'm not working so much to get rid of their migraine headaches or their irritable bowel syndrome or their attention deficit disorder. I'm really more trying to help people get in touch with their own internal resources to take charge of their lives, to learn the appropriate skills to manage themselves. So, you know, there's other practitioners out there that do that, obviously, but, you know, my method is the result of 35 years of application and observation. So, you know, the best I can say to answer that, I'm sorry I'm giving you such a long answer, but the best I can say is, you know, you check the credentials and then you have to get a feel for them. Can this practitioner provide me with what I am searching for? And often that is a very personal thing. Is this person compassionate? Is this person empathetic? And so on and so forth. Those are all important factors. I literally have created our own training. I think it's been about 15 years. I wrote several manuals, and we have very specific training for practitioners who want to be certified by us and say that they're involved with the Wuttke Institute. And I insist that, you know, number one, they go through the treatment themselves. Number two, they have a strong spiritual practice, personal to them, individualized to them in their own lives, and make sure that they're very focused on keeping themselves as functional and as evolved as possible. And then I know they'll make good practitioners. So I can't say that about the rest of the field. You know what I mean? It's not just about pushing buttons, clicking on computer software and saying, okay, go for it. Unfortunately, there's a whole lot more to it than that.
Now, you spoke about the emphasis on spirituality, and you eventually studied the brainwaves of seasoned meditators earlier on in your neurofeedback career, people that achieved enlightenment. So can you talk about this, some of the early sort of research you did and some of the big insights that you took from those earlier days?
Sure. And there's a hierarchy, and I didn't hear the interview that you did with Judith Pennington of The Awakened Mind, but you know, there's a hierarchy of changes that you see the brain go through as someone progresses along the path of meditation, and then learns to achieve higher states of consciousness. And as I said earlier, it does not appear to be one thing. Like, you know, for a long time, oh, if you have a lot of alpha waves, you're a great meditator, or if you go into theta and delta, you're a great meditator. None of that is true. What I did find was it's a relationship in the EEG between, you know, the bandwidths of brainwave activity that are called delta, theta, alpha, beta. And beta has several different components that we look at, plus the highest brainwave frequency or the highest we really can measure accurately is called gamma. So it would appear that it's not one single frequency of brainwave activities. It's the relationship among them. And what that relationship actually means, Judith Pennington's work with the awakened mind, that's what they call it. This is the awakened mind brainwave pattern. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean the person's enlightened? Not necessarily. It does mean that mind is more open and less influenced or driven by fear, doubts, and anxieties. A mind that is more conscious, somebody who's not living like mechanically. But when you get to advanced stages of meditation, you do see the emergence of this gamma, again, in proportion with the rest of the brainwaves. So gamma is grossly misunderstood. It's a binding frequency in the brain. Whenever you have an aha moment, you see this discharge of gamma, and then the whole brain sort of connects. So it's called a synchronizing or a binding rhythm. But gamma is tricky, because before you can get to gamma, you have to have balanced the other brainwaves first. And why that's important is because that means you have to a degree, have quieted the limbic system, or the emotional part of the brain, the reactive part of the brain, the part of the brain we know that is involved with primitive instincts, fight, flight, or freeze responses. This part of the brain has to be quieted. And the reason is because gamma can be like a magnifier. It's like the sunshine. It doesn't care if there's flowers or weeds. It's going to shed light on both of them, and they're going to grow. So if somebody starts doing or working towards gamma prematurely, the flowers will grow, but so will the weeds. And that will create, or can create, quite a bit of disturbance. So you have to approach these things very cautiously, because I do know that there's practitioners out there said, oh, well, Richard Davidson measured all these Tibetan yogis or meditators with permission of the Dalai Lama. And what they found was they have gamma that is far more prevalent than the normal population. Well, does that mean everybody should go out and train gamma and they'll be Tibetan meditators? No, you've got to work your way towards it. You have to practice things that put your life in order. Like in yoga philosophy, those are called the yamas and niyamas, and those are the restraints and the observances. So practicing things like harmlessness, compassion, non-greediness, kind of like the Ten Commandments of yoga. But every spiritual teaching has prerequisite moral ethical principles that are very important. And it's not that they're trying to be religious or moral or ethical, frankly. It's that these attributes that we have, that our brains have to be neutralized and balanced to a degree before we can expand our awareness to higher states of consciousness. Those higher states of consciousness cannot function correctly if there's a lot of, excuse my language, crap down in the brain and nervous system. You know, it's nice to all of a sudden experience a higher state of consciousness and have a vision of bliss or God or whatever, but the rest of the brain and nervous system needs to have the capacity to handle that kind of an experience, so that our egos don't get overblown or we begin to misuse the information that can occur in higher states of consciousness. Mm. So what I found very clearly was that when you see a teacher or a guru or a spiritual leader who suddenly has all these scandals unfold in their lives, yeah, they might be enlightened. And we all sit around scratching our head. How can they be enlightened and, you know, be doing all these nefarious things to the disciples or their flock or whatever? Well, it's because they didn't clean the stuff up that's underneath all that. Higher states of consciousness do not necessarily wipe out all of the crap that we have in our psychological makeup. It makes us see it differently and usually motivates us. But it's kind of like after enlightenment, you have to come down and clean up your human self. You have to take care of the issues. Otherwise, you will not manifest what you really experience in those higher states correctly.
You spoke about sort of stages of development in an ideal trainee. And with each stage, there is a combination of brainwave frequencies that collectively as a whole are sort of goals that you want to move towards. And it's not just one frequency, it's a combination of frequencies. So can you talk about the stages of development and sort of the combination of frequencies that are associated with each?
Again, it depends where you start. So there'll be different types of patterns you begin to recognize when somebody walks in your door. You can see an excessive amount of beta. And depending on the frequencies, you know, beta runs all the way from 13 up to 32 hertz, and then beyond that is gamma. But in those frequencies, 13 to 32, you can see, especially if they tend to be higher frequencies, 25 or 23 and above, you see a lot of chatter going. The brain is really sort of making a lot of noise when we wake up in the middle of the night and our mind is chattering away and we can't sleep and we have, you know, what we all understand as endless loop thinking, type A personalities, people whose minds just don't shut up. That tends to be this higher frequency beta. And these are people who come and say, I've tried to meditate, I just can't do it. Well, that's like saying, I've tried to play the piano, but I just can't do it. You have to practice. So you have to work on these things. So that's one pattern that is quite common, an excessive amount of beta, overthinking. Then there's another pattern where you see excessive theta. So, and we call that slow wave activity. And this can be related to several different things. One can be a pattern that's indicative of depression, can be dissociative disorders where the person literally sort of tends to dissociate from their environment or their experience because of a past trauma. You can see that in attention deficit disorder occasionally as well. So theta is another pattern that we want to make sure is in balance. The other one, of course, is alpha, and alpha can have many different manifestations when you look at somebody's EEG at first. So it can be, some people will have no alpha at all, so their mind is never sort of going into neutral, because in general, alpha is indicative of the brain going into neutral. Now, I do have to say, Tony, I'm really oversimplifying this, so if anybody listening to this is understands EEG, forgive me, but it would be take us hours if I was to go into all the details here. But in general, alpha is this quiet state. So again, it depends on where the person starts. The first thing we want to do likely is to bring down that high beta if they have it. The second thing we want to do is to get theta and alpha in proportion with one another. And that is going to cause a shift in the state of consciousness. As a person advances, though, and this is admittedly advanced, I mean, I'm not talking about weeks or months, but more about years, then we can start looking at the higher frequencies at gamma, and occasionally we'll even look at delta. So we look at delta, theta, alpha, beta proportionally. And, you know, we're looking to, you know, when you hold these brain waves in these proportional rhythms, you begin to give the individual access to the whole range of their being. What the hell does that mean? Well, Swami Rama used to be very fond of saying that there's an infinite library within each individual, and that great inventions, discoveries, eureka moments do not occur from information from the outside. They occur when our being, when we start to discover and access the depths of what is already within our consciousness, each one of us individually. So what happens when you begin to guide the brainwave into this balance of patterns, people's lives begin to change because they're getting access to deeper and much more profound and what I like to call missions of their lives. I mean, we're all here for a reason. I believe, in my opinion, the reason is to wake up, simply. But many people don't know that, number one, or sabotage themselves or are resistant to it. So when you start to meditate and or do neurofeedback and develop these patterns, your life begins to change because you start, we call it dharma. You discover your dharma, your spiritual purpose in life, and all of a sudden that comes out. So that's what you see developing and happening as the brainwave patterns begin to change, because all of the crap that may have limited us or held us back is often reflected in the EEG pattern. And then as you correct the pattern and create the appropriate template, it all starts to manifest.
And step one seems to be quieting the mind. So finding the areas of the brain that are really chattering and quieting that down. So can you talk about, you know, what areas of the brain that typically is associated with this mind chatter, and what's the process like usually to quiet this down?
Sure. Usually it's the back of the brain. Back of the brain, you know, you have the visual cortex back there. And that part of the brain, according to neuroscientists, is really the filing system of the brain. So that's where we store all of our information. That's what makes you, you, me, me. You know, it's kind of like the definitions of ourselves, the definitions of the world. That's why if that part's damaged, you can see some tricky things happen with the person. So the problem is that part of the brain is just simply meant to be the filing system. And oftentimes we'll see an excessive amount of beta back there, which means that we're rumbling through our files trying to find the answer to a question. The truth is the answer's not there. If we would quiet the mind down, then the frontal lobes of the brain, which are where the brain's executive functions occur, the CEO of the brain, if you will, if we can quiet that back part down, we can listen to the CEO. But see, you have to be, you know, this again is not one size fits all. Sometimes when somebody comes in, it's not chatter. It's that when they sit down to close their eyes to meditate, they fall asleep. So it's just the opposite. So there are different things happening. Some is you know, excessive activity. Some is due to deficient activity. So that's why you can't just say, oh, first step for you, just like everybody else, is quieting down your brain. That's not necessarily true. Sometimes you have to learn how to activate certain regions. When you're talking about activation, that tends to be frontal, because the frontal pathways of the brain are driven by dopamine primarily, the neurotransmitter dopamine. Yes, there's 120 other neurotransmitters, but dopamine is that primary driver. The back of the brain tends to be serotonin driven. So we're talking about two very different regions that do different things.
And if you do have this overactivity of the back of the brain and you quiet it down, you were saying how the front section is more in control, this CEO, more the executive function, is being able to exercise itself better. And, you know, when I've always read about things like, you know, neurotic mind chatter, it's associated with this overactivity of the prefrontal cortex. And, you know, you hear a lot about the goal of meditation or flow states or entheogens is to quiet this prefrontal cortex down, which is a little bit different from what you're talking about. So just want to get your take on this, and if there's any areas that need to be, I guess, clarified with this prefrontal cortex.
Yeah, that gets very complicated, and it is true for flow states. It is important for the frontal lobes to quiet down. And the reason is because flow states require sort of a witnessing capacity. It requires that I'm not a firm believer in left-right hemisphere, sort of, oh, you're left-brained or you're right-brained. There's some truth to that, but that's also been proven to be a myth. But there definitely are functions that are more logical. And what happens is when the prefrontal lobes are too activated, we think too much. So you get ready to hit your tennis ball and you're thinking too damn much. You know, do I have to move to the left or the right or up or down? Every athlete and anybody, it doesn't have to be an athlete, but anybody who experiences the flow state knows in that moment they really stop thinking about whatever it is they're doing. The best example I give if people are movie fans is the movie The Last Samurai with Tom Cruise, when he was being trained to use the sword. It was kind of obvious that the more he thought about it, the worse he did. And that finally, and there's a fight scene in it where you can see that he got into the zone or the flow state. In Japanese, it's actually called mushin, which means no mind, mushin. And when you get into that state, you stop thinking about it. Your prefrontal lobes quiet down. And like your brain and nervous system knows how to hit a hole in one on the golf course. Problem is we think about it too much. So when we talk about quieting the prefrontal lobes, that's really what we're talking about, getting out of that thinking state and learn, in other words, worrying about the past, worrying about the future, not being present. So when you finally do that, again, I'm going to call it the right hemisphere, but the right hemisphere takes over. You're completely present. You're not worried about the past. You're not worried about the future. You're present. And when that happens, the brain and the nervous system are in perfect coordination, and you will function optimally. So these are distinguishing characteristics of these different states that we're talking about. And what they've shown, for instance, with meditators is the left prefrontal, advanced meditators, the left prefrontal lobe activates and they go into ecstasy. Okay, that's very different than a flow state. I mean, there's some similarities, but again, it's the relationship with what the rest of the brain is doing as well. So you can't just categorize all these things, I think is what I'm trying to get across here. You have to understand what state you're going for and who the person is, what their brain's doing in the first place, and then guide them appropriately.
When you work with a client and sort of there's this overactivity in the back of the brain, you quiet that down, the frontal lobe, you get it to awaken, and it seems like after that period, you sort of want to up the gamma frequencies. And this is sort of a new brainwave frequency that not a lot of people have heard about before. It's relatively new in the academic community. But seasoned meditators, like you were saying, are associated with generating this gamma brainwave. So can you talk a little bit about gamma? And you spoke about it briefly, but can you go a little bit further about gamma and how it's linked with seasoned meditators?
Yes. So again, it's higher frequency. Some people say it's around 40 hertz. Some people give a broader range. And it was first seen in, I think, the 50s by a couple of French researchers. And they saw it in people who practice Kriya Yoga. I think it was Gauss, G-A-S, and Dastaut, D-A-S-T-A-U-T. They were researchers. And I don't think they quite understood what it was. Then it was seen again in, as I mentioned, by Richard Davidson in his research on some of the Dalai Lama's devotees, advanced meditators. And it's been seen off and on, I think, with TM meditators. So it's definitely associated with a certain type of meditation. You don't see it across the board with, you know, again, there's so many different types of meditation. You have to be specific here. But, you know, here's the thing about gamma. If you start researching it, oh, this is this magic brainwave. Well, guess what other population has an excessive amount of gamma? It happens to be in Alzheimer's. So we can't, you know, you can't be simplistic with these things. That's what I keep trying to point out here. These are not, it's not just A, B, C, D. There's many, many factors that go into these things. So again, gamma sort of is a magnifier of what's going on in the brain. So it's important before one begins to say, well, I'm going to train my gamma waves, that one has quieted down the limbic system, the more primitive parts of the brain. Right now, if you look at humanity collectively, we see a struggle going on between the limbic system, which is fear, fight or flight, survival, competitiveness, territoriality, and the higher cortex, which is rational thinking. The higher cortex, if it was functional, we would not have nuclear weapons on this planet. It's just obviously not a good thing to do. But the limbic system, because of the way we are evolving, I think that we are definitely moving forward now. But the limbic system collectively holds the higher cortex or the cortex hostage, because the limbic system, the primitive areas is what's driving behavior. So when you're talking about things like gamma, you have to make sure that that limbic system is quieted down, that it is free of fear, of rage, of competitiveness, of survival responses, of territoriality, of tribalism. Then the higher cortex can begin to actually have gamma that produces this, you know, what we see in advanced meditators, this very present state of awareness, a very conscious state where literally the meditator is, quite literally, this is actually true, you can look this up, is more awake than the typical or normal person. So gamma is very important, but frankly, we shouldn't even be talking about it. You know, maybe you take meditators who've been meditating for 10 or 20 years, then you can talk about it. And I don't want, you know, I've had people, and there are programs out there that say, oh, just train your gamma waves. And there may or may be certain applications where that's appropriate. I know some clinicians are actually using that for learning disabilities, not for meditation. But it is a very important rhythm, but it has to be approached discreetly and delicately with the appropriate prerequisites before you can jump into it. Mm-hmm. And often, you know, these advanced meditators, they didn't have access to brainwave biofeedback equipment. The result of their meditative practices was that the brain began to produce more gamma waves. So it's going to be the result of the awakening process anyway.
Mm. Now, you were saying the limbic system needs to be quieted down to even think about stepping into things like upping or introducing gamma waves and things like that. Different meditations target different areas of the brain. A lot of people think meditation, it's like this catch-all phrase and it just quiets the whole mind down, but it's really complicated. And each meditation targets different areas of the brain, like I was saying. So in terms of quieting this limbic system, this fear centers and whatnot, is there a specific type of meditation that you would recommend people practice?
Yeah. So first, let's define limbic system. Limbic system is fight, flight, or freeze response. So it's all those things that trigger us. So what we know, and that's the autonomic nervous system. That's the nervous system outside of the central nervous system, largely, that is what is carrying these fight, flight, or freeze responses. It starts in the brain. So the key here is learning how to quiet the autonomic nervous system so we're not always reacting. And it's quite simple, and you'll see this common among almost all meditation teachings, and it's the breath. Your breath is intimately connected to your mind and your nervous system. It is involuntary for 99.9% of our lives. But if we take voluntary, and I don't like to use the word control, but if we learn how to modify our breath so that our breathing pattern is slow, smooth, regular, and most importantly, diaphragmatic breathing, sometimes called belly breathing. But you'll see that these people thousands of years ago who developed these meditation techniques were like neuropsychologists or neurologists. They understood that the way to get the mind to quiet was to use breath awareness and perhaps apply a mantra to the breath awareness, even though studies show that the specific mantra doesn't seem to matter. You can say anything over and over in your mind, and it will still produce the same physiologic and brain effect. But the key is being conscious of your breathing pattern, breathing slow, smooth, and down deep in your belly. Your mind and your body and your nervous system will eventually match your breath pattern. So in other words, if your breath is regular, slow, smooth, indicative of deep relaxation, well, guess what? Your body has to follow along eventually. Now, you know, again, what I said earlier applies here. People say, well, I just can't do that. I try meditation, it doesn't work for me. Again, that's just like saying, well, I tried playing the piano and it just doesn't work for me. This all takes practice. People really have to get that to be patient, takes time. You are literally training yourself. This is physiologic biofeedback. You're being conscious of your own body, of what it's doing, and eventually you learn how to calm and quiet all of this circuitry. And again, breath is the number one technique to do that.
How much can neurofeedback, biofeedback accelerate this process that from what you've seen throughout your years with all the clients that you've worked with?
Tremendously. I mean, with neurofeedback, you're instead of somebody having to, try this door, try that door, try this door, try this teaching, try this teacher, try this technique, biofeedback is very direct, or neurofeedback. We can really direct the individual. I work intensively because I started, my professional work in a hospital where I only had people for 28 days. So I had to learn how to get results quickly. I mean, I had to learn how to enable people to change their lives and get free of their addictions and depression and so on. So what I do is intensive treatment. I treat people twice a day. And usually for 2 or 3 weeks, because we really are pushing the nervous system to change very quickly. And, over 35 years, we have remarkable success with that. We're also getting ready next year or the year after to launch a very elite program, only going to take 6 people at a time, week-long program, and do a super intensity transformational program. But I prefer, if people have particular disorders to work this way, to do it very intensively, not maybe, there obviously if you have a child with attention deficit disorder or autism, that sort of thing, then the treatment or the training might be once or twice a week. But when people are coming to me, as you say, for massive transformation and change, then we're going, the ideal anyway, is to really go for it. And as I say, do an intensive process.
And you still offer this training?
When I say training, see, we want to differentiate neurofeedback from a treatment process or a training process. Okay, mm-hmm. It's really not treatment. You are hooking the person up to a machine, and they are training themselves. They are training their own brainwaves. So I just want to specify that, because I'm not talking about training clinicians or training people how to be brainwave biofeedback therapists. I'm talking about we are training the individual how to modify their own brainwave patterns.
Right. And I actually found out about you, like I was saying, through Adam Curry, who 10 years ago, he did a 2-week intensive with you. And he said he was very clear on this. That was the most profound experience of his life. And I thought that was amazing, and that's why I had to contact you. So can you take us through, briefly what goes on in this 2 weeks?
Yeah, I mean, we're in Santa Barbara, which is this beautiful Central Coast California city. So what happens is people will come from around the United States, around the world, and they'll find a place to stay. I'll do an interview beforehand, or one of my staff will, and we'll determine if what we do is appropriate for them. We have them fill out a lot of history and paperwork, and then they'll come here and we start the process with a quantitative EEG to look at their brains, what's going on. And then I design the training plan. In other words, I decide where we're going to start and what their, and this of course is according to what their goals are. So we jump right into it because, you know, 2 weeks is a short amount of time, but if we can do everything correctly, we can get quite a lot of change to occur in the brain and nervous system. So that first day is where we're determining and deciding the direction we need to go in. And I tell everybody, you know, the nervous system adjustments and the neuroplasticity that occurs is sort of like playing a chess game. We know what checkmate is, but getting there may be a circuitous route, to say the least. So I watch everything, every session that a client goes through here. We have a 3,000 square foot office, so we have several treatment rooms and several staff members who assist me. But what we're doing all week long is running clients through the process, adjusting things if they need to be adjusted, referring people out if I feel they need to be referred to. If I feel like somebody has some kind of major psychological issue or trauma, relationship issue, and so on, I will make sure if they do not have their own personal private counselor, therapist, psychologist, I will make sure that they have one here if they indeed want to go through the process. We may refer out for body work. I mean, body work is one of the most compatible or as a whole compatible interventions with neurofeedback. So things like somatic therapies, acupuncture, not just plain old massage, but usually massage that has a more emotional therapeutic component to it. Again, some of the, in Santa Barbara here, we have some of the best healers and practitioners around. Then if I see that there are potential dietary or supplement issues, I may either refer out or make the appropriate recommendations there. So all that happens pretty quickly, and I can do that pretty quickly because I've done this so many times. And then we launch the process twice a day, usually morning and afternoon. Sometimes, depending on a person's energy levels, we might try to fit both sessions in either morning or afternoon. And people are basically on their own the rest of the time. And the reality is most people need a lot of downtime when they go through the intensive process. You know, a person can't do their normal job. They can't do their normal activities. Many times a lot of suppressed memories are coming up that need to be processed, stuff that they may have considered that, you know, they're long gone, attended to or integrated. And oftentimes what you'll find is that there's history from childhood or, you know, later than childhood that is still running your life. And that often comes up. It's like the brainwave patterns, in order to shift, have to let go of a lot of past hurts, resentments, pains, whatever, guilt, shame, whatever. So that is often part of the process. So they get the weekend off. Then the last week we go through the same process. And I also have to say that this is not a magic bullet. This doesn't, you know, dramatically change everybody's life who come here. Many people it does, but there are still some people who know at the end of the 2 weeks they still have a lot of work to do. And oftentimes what happens is when people leave here after an intensive is they have to sort of digest the experience and integrate it into their lives. If I can find them a referral to continue with wherever they live, I do. But this is also one of the reasons that I'm working on this focus band project that I mentioned earlier, the headband, portable EEG headband. We have the apps, you know, it has an app so you can put it on your phone, very simple to use. And I'm trying to develop that according to my specifications, so that people will have that after they go through the intensive process to continue their own work at home. Many people will come back after doing intensives, especially if they're within distance, for what we call booster sessions every few weeks to continue to move the process along. But there are people who, you know, as Adam mentioned to you, who after 2 weeks, it's changed their lives. And for the rest of their lives, they can tell that the effects are still occurring. Their brain has been aimed in the right direction. They've cleared up a lot of stuff that has been either, you know, in the way, obstacles in their lives. And it just continues on and on and on. So that's very nice, too. You know, there's different theories about how many sessions of neurofeedback you need before you have permanent plasticity or permanent change. And that varies a lot. Some clinicians say 20 to 40, some say 40 to 60. So nobody's really figured that one out yet. We do know that it does take, you know, depending on how deep the ruts are in the brain, how much we have to change, well, it's going to be proportional.
And a typical, so you do two sessions a day for 2 weeks. What is a session typically like?
Well, it depends. Depending on what we're doing, the client gets hooked up to the computers, and there's two forms of, actually three forms that we use. The majority of it is interactive, so the person is either watching a game or watching a video, and that video or that game is responding according to how they're training or shaping their brain waves. Usually one session is like that, lasts roughly an hour. They may not actually be doing the training for the full hour, usually more like 30 minutes, depending. But one session a day is usually interactive. The second session tends to be more passive, where we use pulsed electromagnetic fields, which is, you know, the next biggest change in medicine I think we're going to see is the emergence of pulsed electromagnetics. It's becoming a big thing already. And we will use that. We have several systems that we use here. That is generally to deepen the relaxation effect, to work with the autonomic nervous system, and to train specific frequencies in the brain and or in the body. Often we'll use some of the pulsed electromagnetics on the body. It can be very profound. So what we found is the combination of sort of this passive and then interaction type of training process produces these very strong changes in the brain and nervous system.
Now, you mentioned the focus band, and a lot of people here are in the DIY biohacking community. Yeah. On a hardware level, are there any consumer level or even lower cost professional level EEG devices that you would recommend those to try out?
There's a lot of them. I mean, there's a lot of open source now. You know, I think Muse, even though I'm not thrilled, I tell you why I like focus band, because the electrical engineer who created it put in a very specific filter. So that's why athletes are going for it. Most of the systems out there are extremely sensitive to artifact or to movement. So you have to sit there and be very still while you use them. That is not true of the focus band. Golfers go out on the golf course and wear it while they play golf and do feedback to make sure they're in the appropriate state. So that's why I like the focus band. You know, there are inexpensive professional systems, and by inexpensive, you know, under $2,000. I do like Judith Pennington's Mind Mirror. I have one on order. Getting that, and that's only, you know, approximately 2000. That's a very good system, and it also has you know, it has some autonomic measures too. It has a heartbeat and perspiration response built in. I have you know, I have not tried it yet, but from what I can tell and what I can see, it looks like a very useful system for, you know, what you're calling consciousness hackers or biohackers. I think that, and what I like so much about it, it is based on this awakened mind paradigm.
Have you heard of the Open BCI and sort of the 3D printing type of EEG devices that are out there? And there's a lot of open source software with that. Want to get your thoughts on the newer trend.
Yeah, I think that, you know, as they're developed, and it really takes a considerable expertise, at least as far as directing how they are developed. But I think all of those have huge potential. It's just, as I said, though, it you know, I get concerned when people get into this novelty aspect of neurofeedback and start turning it into, you know, sort of a sci-fi or alternative to psychedelic thing, because it's not that at all. And that's a little concerning. But I think, number one, that's inevitable. That's going to happen as this field grows. But number two, if the appropriate people are consulted and work with, you know, experts in these developments, I think it can go very nicely. And I happen to know there's some big, very big companies who are really researching this, and because they obviously they see this as a big wave. So hopefully the money's going to go in the right direction.
Mm. Now, if people want to take this further, is there any, you said there's only a few individuals that you'd personally recommend, but who are these individuals if people want to learn to train how to do this and take this thing to the next level if they want to?
I think people would need to email me and tell me where they are. I don't like giving out that information broadly. You know, I if somebody says, yeah, I live, you know, in Wisconsin or Pennsylvania or Florida, I can sort of guide them to somebody I may or may know there. I may not know them. I mean, there's practitioners everywhere now. They're all over the place. But, you know, again, I only refer to people I know, and I know that their training has been good and so on. Has less to do with credentials and more to do with the individual, as always.
You know? And if people want to learn more, just introduction books or resources, anything that you'd recommend?
There's lots of them. The main book that is written for the general public is called Symphony in the Brain by Jim Robbins. Symphony in the Brain, and then I think it's Evolution of the New Brainwave Biofeedback. That's a good book, gives sort of the history and the development of neurofeedback. If people are really interested in the trauma aspect, there's an awesome book that's about a lot more than neurofeedback. It's called The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel, B-E-S-S-E-L, van der Kolk. He's out there on the East Coast, quite an amazing guy. But it's The Body Keeps the Score. And then there's a whole chapter in there on neurofeedback that really explains neurofeedback, what it is, how it works, and the potential of it. There's many other books out there, not necessarily for the general public. There's a neurofeedback book on neurodevelopmental trauma. I mean, there's probably half a dozen other ones out there as well. But I think Symphony in the Brain might be the best one to start with for most people. And again, if people are interested in trauma, then van der Kolk's book, even though it's just one chapter on neurofeedback, the rest of the book is excellent as well.
Mm. Are there any other thought leaders in this neurofeedback field that you find yourself paying attention to and respect?
I mean, there's many leaders in the field who are, you know, kind of getting old and gray, myself included. But, you know, this field has many pioneers now that have pushed it along. The thing is, we all are sort of in agreement, and some of us are on our own trajectories. So my trajectory is, as I mentioned, the spiritual part. I'm less concerned about the diagnosis people come to see me with and more focused on their spiritual growth and their spiritual awakening. And as I, you know, there's probably other practitioners out there, you know, moving in that direction. But honestly, I've had to keep my attention very much on what I'm doing. I don't, frankly, at least for the past 5 years, I don't pay a lot of attention to what's going on in the rest of the field because I have so much going on myself.
Mm. Well, Marty, thanks so much for sitting down with me. If folks want to learn more about you and your institute, where can they best find all that good stuff online?
Our website, WuttkeInstitute.com. It's my last name, institute.com.
All right. I want to say a special thanks to Martin for sitting down with me and teaching us all a lot more about brainwaves and neurofeedback and biofeedback and all the benefits that we can get using these transformative technologies. And if you enjoyed today's episode, go check out his website, WuttkeInstitute.com, to learn more about his services and especially the neurofeedback intensive that we were talking about earlier. And if you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast, Warrior Radio. Subscribe, tell a friend, and give us a rating, because it really helps push this podcast up the iTunes charts and gets little understood, little talked about topics such as neurofeedback out into the public. So with all that said, I want to say thanks to you for sitting down with me today, and I will see you on the next one. Take care. Bye-bye.